Grounded, Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump orders the immediate grounding of all Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft. This after two crashes involving MAX 8s in Indonesia and Ethiopia, raising serious safety questions. Trump is following the lead of other countries, which had already said,
once might have been a one-off. Twice, we're nervous. We're grounding our airplanes.
We'll have the latest. Also today, young women trying to escape Saudi Arabia's strict gender rules must first escape their families. This woman did it during a family trip by handing a note to airport staff.
It says, I want asylum. My family doesn't know. Please protect me from them.
Now she's living in the UK. Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The Boeing 737 MAX 8, the airplane that crashed on Sunday in Ethiopia, killing everyone on board, it's officially grounded in the U.S. President Trump made that decision this afternoon. International pressure had been building with a long list of countries barring the plane from their airspace in the last few days. The World's Jason Margolis joins me now in the studio with an update. So what exactly did Trump order today?
Well, just this afternoon, President Trump issued an emergency order, and he said that all of these Boeing airplanes were grounded in the United States, and the ones that were currently in the air, they could finish their flight, obviously, and then they had to come back down, and they were grounded. And here's what the president said.
And we acted also very fact-based and very much working with other countries and with the airlines. Okay?
So, Jason, when there is a grounding protocol like this that's ordered, there's typically a set of guidelines on how to get out of the grounding. Do we know at this point what's going to happen next?
We don't know exactly what is going to happen next because this has happened very few times. It happened in 1979. The FAA grounded all McDonnell Douglas DC-10s after a crash in Chicago killed almost 300 people. The investigation found that the problem was actually maintenance issues, not aircraft design. And the FAA lifted the prohibition after a month. In early 2013, Boeing's 787 Dreamliners were grounded after there was a problem with lithium-ion batteries. Mm-hmm. That happened early in the year. And about a little under 4 months later, the airplanes were allowed to fly again. So that's all we know. This has happened very few times. The FAA has a very, very, very good safety record because they don't allow planes to fly until they're proven to be safe. So this is very rare.
So we should also note that it's not just the 737 MAX 8, it's also the MAX 9 model as well. This recent crash of the MAX 8 that happened in Ethiopia, there was also another 737 MAX 8 involved in a similar crash in Indonesia last year. How well synchronized is the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration with the rest of the world?
Well, every country gets to decide its own protocols, but if one of these airplanes is flying into Canadian airspace or European airspace, they can say, no, no, you can't fly that airplane into our space. So they are synchronized in that account. But if something is going from Boston to Atlanta or Seattle to Milwaukee, that is up to the FAA as it would be up to the country if it's an intercountry flight.
So let me just play a segment for all of us of an interview I did earlier today with David Learmount. He's an aviation journalist in the UK and a former pilot. And he was talking about these different philosophies to dealing with problems like these, technical problems, when they crop up.
I think it helps to contrast the way the rest of the world sees this. America says, hey, we briefed our pilots extremely well. If a problem does arise, we can trust them to deal with it. Now, the rest of the world is not taking that approach. It's taking an approach something like this. It's a bit more traditional. It says, look, we are not going to give our pilots an airplane that might have a software fault that we don't fully understand yet, and then ask our pilots to save us from its faults. It's a completely different approach. America's, well, very American. It's very much can do. We briefed our pilots. They can handle it.
So that's a British aviation journalist and former pilot David Learmount there. Jason Margolis, before the Trump announcement this afternoon, Canada had joined the list of countries grounding the 737 MAX 8. Was this a case, do you think, of the U.S. just really didn't have a choice in the interest of passenger safety to be one of the last holdouts, not grounding the plane? And how important to this decision, to Trump's decision, do you think is the fact that Boeing is an American company.
Right. So several U.S. senators were putting pressure on the president and the FAA to ground the planes. So there was mounting pressure. Was the FAA resistant or the president resistant because it's an American company? That is speculation. But what I can tell you this, right after the president made his announcement, the Boeing stock tanked. So there is a direct correlation between a U.S. company and what the president says here.
The World's Jason Margolis, thanks very much for updating us on the story.
You're welcome. Fast-moving story.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo once referred to his State Department as the Department of Swagger. But take a look at the federal budget proposal Trump submitted this week, and there's a lot less money to fuel the swagger. The Trump administration says it wants to slash spending at the State Department by nearly a quarter. The fight is still to come in Congress over the spending levels, but here's a larger question. What do Trump's budget priorities say about American diplomacy? The World's Matthew Bell has that one.
Whatever you think of Trump's foreign policy, he's been personally engaged in ways that previous presidents were not.
I think very importantly, the relationship is, just very strong. And when you have a good relationship, a lot of good things happen.
Trump met face-to-face with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un last month for the second time.
So we have made a lot of effort so far, and we thought that now is time for us to come to Hanoi, sit together, and then have this wonderful dialogue.
The president's supporters give him high marks for doing things differently, rolling up his sleeves and taking the helm on big diplomatic challenges. Not Madeleine Albright, though.
I mean, I teach a course on decision making at Georgetown University. He would fail it.
Speaking to Newsday, the former Secretary of State said Trump confuses American allies and emboldens enemies, which is not how U.S. diplomacy is supposed to work. When I asked Daniel Dresner, professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, how he would grade Trump's record on diplomacy, here was his response.
I'm not supposed to laugh at that question. I really don't think there's an objective way you can describe this as anything other than an unmitigated disaster.
Dresner says the Trump administration doesn't have much to show for its highest profile diplomatic efforts. North Korea's nuclear program, the renegotiation of NAFTA, trade with China, none of those have been big successes. But there's a larger problem, Dresner says, that's not making headlines.
Under this administration, you've seen a mass exodus of the most skilled and trained diplomats from the State Department. That will take years and perhaps decades to sort of rebuild that kind of human capital reserve. It's not easy to replace automatically. And this administration's rather cavalier approach to the State Department is not going to make that any easier.
Dresner says it's hard to talk about restoring the swagger to American diplomacy when there's a proposal to slash spending at the State Department by 23%. Even if Congress decides to restore that funding, it still sends a strong signal that diplomacy is not a top priority. And no president, Dresner says, can do it all himself.
Now, there's no denying that the president should obviously have the loudest voice in foreign policy and should be able to veto or put a stop to foreign policy initiatives that he doesn't like. But the idea that the president alone can fix America's foreign policy problems or address all of America's foreign policy challenges is absurd.
Most of the proposed funding cuts at the State Department are in specific areas, international development and foreign aid. That's important stuff, says Matthew Kranig of the Atlantic Council, but there's something more important.
If you have to choose, I think the military aspect of the competition is really heating up now with the return of great power competition from Russia and China. There is a bipartisan consensus that we need to spend more on defense, have a more serious defense strategy for Russia and China, including developing new technologies, artificial intelligence, next-generation missile defenses. And these are things that are going to receive adequate funding in the new budget.
On diplomacy overall, Kranig says he gives Trump a mixed review.
Trump's really reset relations with Israel, with the Gulf states, taken a tougher line on Iran. In Asia, making North Korea a priority is something the South Koreans and Japanese are pleased with. Europe has been where the relations have been more complicated. So not perfect, but I'd say probably better than they're getting credit for.
Kranig also teaches at Georgetown's School of Foreign Service. For his students who look at the Trump administration and worry about starting a career as an American diplomat, he tells them it's the country they will be serving, not the president. and that they shouldn't let the politics of the moment dissuade them from the job. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
When Saudi women won the right to drive, it was the first time many of them actually got behind the wheel of a car. Shocked the excitement up largely to the activists who fought to get rid of the driving ban. But shortly before it was lifted, those same activists were arrested. Lujin Al-Hathloul is one of them. Today she faced trial in Saudi Arabia. Alma Hassoun is with the BBC's Arabic service. What is the latest on Hathloul's trial, Alma? Like, what is she actually being charged with?
The last thing, and maybe the only confirmed news about the trial, which has so far seemed to be ambiguous, was that it started and ended before midday, and her brother did confirm this. Unfortunately, as we understood, the media, diplomats were not allowed to enter. So there are no reports yet. We don't know what did happen. And her brother did say yesterday on Twitter that there were no official or like public list of charges against his sister.
So the brother of Lujin Al-Hathloul, that's Waleed, the one who lives in Canada, is that right?
Correct. And by the way, Lujain, she's a very prominent activist. However, the rest of women are also very prominent. However, what I understood from a conversation with a legal expert, I mean, he's a Saudi opposition, is that the families of the rest of the detainees are scared. They cannot speak because they are, most of them are inside the kingdom. He said that Lujain's sister and brother, who are living abroad, have been playing a vital, a very important role in her advocacy. That's why we see Lujain more.
Alma, help us understand this paradox. On one hand, Saudi Arabia lifts the driving ban on women. On the other, it arrests activists like Hathloul, who championed the driving ban and made it happen. Can you explain that?
So the Saudi authorities did detain many women and, of course, a number of male supporters around 1 month before the ban was lifted. The authorities were trying to claim the whole achievement, the whole victory, and they were trying to undermine the role of the activist despite of the long struggle. And also state media was trying to frame them as traitors, and they were saying that the activists were undermining the state security.
And why do you think the Saudi monarchy would do this? Because, I mean, isn't it good publicity to show that they are making changes, that women now have the right to drive?
Marco, as many NGOs say, they want to silence opposition, to silence different voices. Otherwise, you know, inside the kingdom, more and more people, including women, will be demanding more rights. Now, what many Saudi women want is not only driving. They were saying that there are many issues like domestic violence. There are other issues. It's about the day to day. So, of course, it was symbolic, the lift of the driving ban. However, they said that there are more deep rooted social issues in the society. And again, domestic violence is only one of them.
That's Alma Hassoun of the BBC's Arabic service telling us about the trial of a Saudi activist who fought to get the women's driving ban lifted in Saudi Arabia. In the past few months, there have been several high-profile stories of Saudi women trying to escape from their abusive families. But the personal toll on them is high. Our story on that, just ahead. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We've been recently witnessing several high-profile attempts by women to flee from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries. And they're not alone. More and more women from this region are taking dangerous measures to escape abusive families. But failed attempts can be extremely costly, as The World's Shireen Jafari reports.
She said she wanted to go to the bathroom. Her sister and mom said they would go too. It was last October. An 18-year-old Donna knew this was her only chance.
When I saw them go inside, I just go out.
They were at Heathrow Airport in London, on their way back to Saudi Arabia after a trip to the US. Donna, who didn't want me to use her last name, says her life in Saudi Arabia, in her father's house, was extremely restricted.
My dad, he's my guardian. He controlled everything, just everything. I can't leave the house. I can't go to the supermarket without permission from him. And even if I took permission, I never go out alone.
There were things she liked about her life, like her grey cat, Tutu. Donna says she had secretly renounced Islam, and if her father found out, he would have killed her. So when she was on the plane to Heathrow, she wrote a note.
It says, I want asylum. My family doesn't know. Please protect me from them.
Donna walked out of the restroom, went up to an airport staff, and handed over the note.
At that moment, I forgot everything. I forgot how to speak. And then when she saw me crying and told her that my family would come down, she talked to another airport staff, and they took me to a smaller room.
Donna's mother and sister kept calling and sending frantic messages. She didn't respond. She was already gone. Women from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries are increasingly finding ways to run away from abusive families.
I want asylum.
We have been hiding in Hong Kong since September 2018. We have moved location 30.
Their stories are getting out now because of the videos they post online.
And everyone actually thinks that it's so easy to leave your country, to leave your family, the people, your own flesh and blood. But it's not. It's actually the hardest thing I ever had to do.
So this video could save my life. And if you are watching this video, it's not such a good thing. Either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
These are some of their voices. Rahaf Mohammed, sisters Reem and Robana, currently stuck in Hong Kong. Lina and Princess Latifa, the daughter of the Prime Minister of the United Arab Emirates. According to the United Nations, in 2005, 151 Saudi citizens applied for asylum in another country. By 2017, that number jumped to 2,000. Adam Kugel of Human Rights Watch says Saudi women have to resort to escape plans because of what's known as guardianship laws.
Every Saudi woman must have a male guardian who has to make critical decisions on their behalf. Women don't have the right to get a passport, travel outside the country, get married.
Women have to get an approval from a male relative, a father, brother, uncle, or son, to be allowed to leave the country. And if they happen to have a strict guardian, well, they're stuck. But a good escape plan can take years to map out. Anoud Al-Ali started plotting hers when she was 16 years old.
I started saving money at that point, up until the night I escaped. I saved up nearly $3,500 in 2 years.
Al-Ali says her older brother abused her physically and mentally. Her stepbrother abused her sexually, she says. And so for 2 years, she became obsessed with leaving Dubai, where she lived with her family.
I used to stay up late at night to know when everyone sleeps. When does everyone wake up? I felt like 3 a.m. is the best thing I could do.
Even though Al-Ali didn't need a travel permit like women in Saudi Arabia do, she still had to get a hold of her passport. Her mother kept it in a drawer in her bedroom.
I stole it. I just found it in my mom's wardrobe and I took it and no one noticed, so I went to my room immediately.
A few days later, she booked a flight, stayed up until 3 a.m. and called an Uber.
I had my sister sleeping with me, so I had to slowly take out my things, wear my clothes, and just go out of the house. And it was dark.
The ride to the airport was short, about 10 minutes, she says. On the way, she thought about what would happen if her brother found out. He would kill her, she says. But surprisingly, she wasn't scared.
It wasn't terrifying. I love adventure. I'm very adventurous. All I had in mind is either freedom or death.
Al-Ali is in France now. She's applied for asylum and is waiting to hear back. She says she wants to study engineering, something her brother wouldn't approve of. But other women haven't been so lucky. This is Dina Ali Lasloum, an English teacher from Riyadh. 2 years ago, she ran away from Saudi Arabia but was stopped at Manila Airport in the Philippines. Lasloum begged airport officials to let her stay, but they handed her back to her family. Witnesses told Human Rights Watch she was forced on a plane back to Saudi Arabia. Her mouth, hands, and feet were duct taped. And there's been no word from her since. Adam Kugel of Human Rights Watch says that shows how dangerous these escape attempts can be.
Of the women who have been returned that we know about, some have faced, usually they face confiscation of mobile phones, forced confinement, limiting of contact. In worse circumstances, they can face potential violence or even, honor-related violence or honor killings, so-called.
The women I spoke to for this story said they did reach out for help when they were abused, but they were either ignored or returned to their abusive fathers and brothers. Kugel says while there are shelters and hotlines in Saudi Arabia to report domestic violence,
women generally can be reticent to go to the police with these accusations because they generally will intervene, but they'll sort of attempt to reconcile. And oftentimes what they'll do is get male guardians who have clearly committed the abuse to just sign, you know, statements saying they won't do it again.
But the potentially grave consequences of running away haven't stopped these women. Donna, the woman who made her escape at Heathrow Airport, is now living in the UK.
I'm living a normal life now, like any other person in the world. So, of course, I'm so happy with that.
She wants to go to school, maybe study law. And as for what she misses from her life in Saudi Arabia, her mom, she says, and her cat, Tutu. For the world, Shirin Jafari.
I don't know how to pronounce the song's title in Turkish, but in English it means Sun's Song. It's from the duo Minor Empire. They call Toronto home now, but their thoughts are never far from their homeland, Turkey. This is from their new album, Uprooted. Music from Minor Empire. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. This teacher took part in some of the first anti-government protests in Aleppo, Syria. He remembers the optimism he felt then.
Because freedom was so close to us. The light was so close.
Things look very different now after 8 years of war in Syria. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Arab Spring held so much promise for so many people. Some dreams in some countries were realized, but in Syria, it's been nightmares since 2011. 8 years ago this week, a peaceful uprising began in Syria. The first protest in the capital, Damascus, was caught on film. The revolution was a protest against the tyranny and corruption of President Bashar al-Assad. His regime's response has been brutal.
Syria has seen 6 days of unprecedented unrest in which a total of 10 civilians have now died at the hands of the country's military.
This morning, President Obama called on Assad to step aside.
More than 1,000 are dead tonight in Syria, and Syrian rebels say they are victims of a poison gas attack.
On that terrible night, the world saw in gruesome detail the terrible nature of chemical weapons and why the overwhelming majority of humanity has declared them off limits. A crime against humanity, and a violation of the laws of war.
Violation or not, the international community did nothing. Back in 2011, when all of this started, Abdul Kafi Al-Amda was an English teacher in Aleppo. He was one of those protesters in the beginning of the uprising against Assad. Today, he's a marked man. When Assad's forces conquered Aleppo at the end of 2016, Abdul Kafi was forced to flee to the province of Idlib. That's now the last rebel stronghold in Syria. He and his family and at least 2 million other Syrians are trapped in that province with nowhere else to go. My colleague Carol Hill spoke with him while he was at home with his young family.
Abdul Kafi, take us back to 2011. Do you remember how you felt when you first heard about the protests?
In fact, at the beginning, until now, by the way, you know, I supported it quickly and I joined it from the first day. In fact, everyone, every human being who like democracy, who like freedom, who like to live as a free man, in fact, was very, very happy at the beginning of these protests. Although it was dangerous, although many of us were being arrested.
So it sounds like basically you stood up for what you thought was right. Almost 8 years later, what has it cost you?
You know, the cost was more than we think. We didn't think that the cost would be so high because freedom was so close to us. The light was so close. So I thought that we really paid, you know, very high price. But nevertheless, we don't regret at all. I mean, if you asked me, if you went 8 years ago, would you participate in these demonstrations? I would say yes, and yes, and yes.
For you personally, what has it cost? What sort of losses have you suffered?
Yeah, look, I lost a lot of friends, a lot of teachers, a lot of colleagues. I mean, some of them are old friends and some of them are new. Every year I lose many, and whenever I make new friends, I lose some of them.
Abdul Kafi Alhamdo is an English teacher in Syria. You're from Aleppo, but you now live in Idlib. Why were you forced to leave Aleppo?
Look, before 2016, we were living in Aleppo. That city I considered paradise on earth, but Assad turned it into hell, and we were besieged. We were destroyed, we were killed, and we were, you know, we were forced to eat things that you cannot imagine that we should eat during the siege. We had to be displaced. I didn't move from that city because I wanted to. But of course, if I chose to stay there, this means that worse than hell, worse than displacement. Because some of my friends, in fact, who stayed there, all of them, now they are either dead or in prison.
You have two children. Tell us about them. How old are they?
Yeah, the oldest is Lamar. She's now 3 years. We celebrated her birthday just in 12th of February. And the other is Muhammad, 6 months old. Of course, Lamar was born in Aleppo, and I hope that she would be brought up there. If you can hear, I'm going to ask her, where are you from? And she's going to say Aleppo, if it's okay.
Sure.
Lamar, where are you from?
Aleppo.
Did you hear her?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, always I remind her that she's from there.
The war has been going on for 8 years. Your oldest child is only three. They've known nothing but war. What future do you see for them?
Although you look, I mean, it's difficult. And of course, having two kids make me, love life more. And, trying to speak up more, to speak to the world, to help more. Although I know that it's useless, in fact, because we know that none will help us. But I hope that one day, we could live in Syria without the same regime, because living again in the same regime is impossible, something impossible. I want to live here, and nevertheless, I want freedom here. Yeah, I might pay price. I know that. All those who passed away paid price, and we pay this price for the next generation, not for ourselves.
Abdul Kafi, what lessons have you learned from standing up and trying to fight for freedom? I mean, was it worth it?
Yeah, it was. I still remember that when my father was always telling me, please, my son, keep silent, don't say any word. Walls have ears, please, safety is first. God willing, and alhamdulillah, we are alive. That's the most important. No, it's not the most important for me. To live as a free man is the most important. To live with your choice. To live and you can speak. This is the life. But living without having any, ability to speak, without having any ability to decide what you want or whom should rule the country, this is not life. This is another kind of slavery, a new kind of slavery. This is what I believe.
Abdelkafi, what hope do you have left at this point?
Okay. I hope that, you know, yeah, we might not be helped. We might be left alone again and again, and we might suffer, we might die. I know that. But at least now, if we wouldn't be helped by you, at least speak about us well. Speak about us that at least the next generations would know that we really wanted just freedom. I want for the next generations, and I want for all people, I mean, inside Syria and outside Syria, to speak about us proudly.
Abdelkafi, I want to thank you for speaking with us. Abdelkafi Alhamdo is an English teacher. He now lives with his family in Idlib, the last major pocket in Syria that's in rebel hands. Thank you so much, Abdelkafi.
Thank you.
Wow, an extraordinary 8 years in the life of one man in Syria. By the way, today, Abdelkafi's neighborhood in Idlib is under bombardment again. Amr al-Azm is also from Syria. He was and is part of the opposition to Bashar al-Assad. Now, Amr is a professor of Middle East history at Shawnee State University in Ohio. I asked him how he thinks the conflict in Syria might end.
Militarily speaking, Assad has won against the opposition in general, but the country is still relatively divided into, you know, obviously areas that are under nominal opposition control. So as long as Assad is in charge, and he has no incentive to find some sort of resolution that includes all the different parties, then I don't think this war is going to end anytime soon.
But Amr al-Azm, I mean, for someone who counts themselves among the opposition to Assad mm-hmm. and this regime, I mean, have you been struggling to accept a reality that maybe the Assads are here to stay?
Oh, it's very difficult and very painful as well. I mean, you know, for many, not just myself, but for many others, you know, we've lost more than just the fact that, you know, the conflict didn't go our way, or let's say we failed to remove Assad, but it goes to the fact that there's also a very strong likelihood that I will never be able to return to Syria. I'll never be able to see my friends back there. I'll never be able to visit that part of the world again. And you know, that is a bleak picture to hold on to. And now, in a way, I kind of look at this and think, well, for me, it's done. Maybe my grandchildren will have that opportunity one day. Who knows? Mm.
As you know, as many as 1 in 4 Syrians have fled the country and hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. What about the human cost? Was 2011 worth that?
I mean, the human cost is catastrophic. But you cannot look at it in terms of just simple, you know, cost benefit. You know, was it worth it or was it not worth it? Because there is no, you know, positive outcome from it yet. But I think the question should be more, should the lesson be then that we would never try to do something like that again? That's what the regime would want us to think. That's exactly what the regime wants, that you've been taught a lesson that, you know, you would never consider challenging this regime again in any way. And I think if that's what the regime wanted, then yes, it is worth the cost, because regimes like us should never be allowed to think that they could to continue to act the way they do with complete impunity and without any form of repercussions. And at the end of the day, the regime might have won, might win even the war, because the war is not over yet. But winning the peace is something completely different. And I don't think the Syria that they have won will ever look anything like the Syria that they lost.
Amr al-Azm, professor of Middle East history at Shawnee State University. Thank you very much, as always.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, we'll look at how the conflict in Syria has impacted the rest of the world. One writer thinks it was a test of our commitment to human rights and of our ability to tell truth from lies.
I do think Syria provided a test for all of these things, and I'd say it was sort of resoundingly, you know, poor marks from everybody.
Be with us tomorrow for that story. Right now in Murmansk, Russia, hundreds of swimmers from all over the world are gathering for the Ice Swimming Championships. Yep. Organizers have cut through the frozen lake to make an Olympic-sized pool in the icy water. The rules are you swim 1,000 meters, you're only allowed to wear a bathing suit, swim cap, and goggles, and you're not allowed to die of hypothermia. I reached British ice swimmer Kate Steeles earlier today in Murmansk, where, incidentally, it's 5 degrees Fahrenheit outside and the water is a brisk 32 degrees.
We went and had a little swim in what they call the Walrus Hole, which is a small, like, 10-meter ice hole. We went there at 10 o'clock this morning and I had to break the ice that had frozen overnight so we could have a dip in there. So if you're not in the water, it starts to refreeze straight away because it's below freezing.
Yeah. Okay. When you get in water like that, what does that feel like? I mean, what is your first physical reaction?
Because we acclimatize, we don't get that really cold shock, like, but you feel it, you get in. It's important to concentrate on breathing out. You don't dive in, you don't tumble turn. So we get in down ladders slowly, get our one shoulder under, and then the referee will set us on our way and we race the 40 lengths.
Kate, much respect, but WTF, what the hell are you thinking doing this sport? I mean, what do you actually get out of it?
Well, this is a real challenge. It's an extreme challenge when you finished it and you've recovered, you've warmed up, you get a real, real buzz. The endorphins flow and you feel really good and that feeling lasts for several days.
So let's talk about being warm. What is your routine once you get out of the water? Is there like kind of a hot drink that you go to or just a something that you do once you're done with this ice swimming business?
So it's slightly different here in Murmansk. You've got absolutely first class facilities. Here what they'll do is you'll get checked over by a doctor as soon as you get out of the water. You have a swim buddy or a second who's been watching you swimming all the time. They will stay with you and they will help walk you up to the main building area where inside there'll be the recovery area. And the Russians have got it down to a really fine art. Your hands and feet will be placed in buckets of quite cool water, but it won't feel cold when you get out of the water. It'll feel quite hot. And you'll have hot, wet towels put all around you, armpits, neck, kidneys, groin, and they keep changing those really rapidly. And then as you start to recover, you start to become more able to have, I don't know, you want to chat more rather than just concentrating on how cold you are. You start to feel better. When you start to get warmer, they will then say you're well enough to get into the sauna. And then you might shiver in the sauna for a little while. But once you come out of that sauna, you know, your endorphins are running. It's just amazing. You're on cloud nine.
Ice swimmer Kate Steeles at the Ice Swimming Championships in Murmansk, Russia. Stay warm somehow doesn't seem right, so I'll just say good luck. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Time to check in again with the world's Carolyn Beeler. She's been sailing for the last 6 weeks on a research ship traveling to Antarctica's massive Thwaites Glacier. It's part of a 5-year international effort to figure out how climate change might be affecting the glacier and what that might mean for global sea level rise over the next 100 years or so. Carolyn, where are you now?
We are off of some ice shelves to the north of Thwaites Glacier, but until recently we were looking at Pine Island Glacier, which is the sister to Thwaites, part of this giant West Antarctic ice sheet. And for the past several days, there's been a lot of sediment coring going on. So dropping a big metal tube down into the seafloor to pull up sediment that is sort of a historical record of what's happened here in the past. So that's what we've been doing on the science side of things. But on the R&R side of things, the great 2019 Nathaniel B. Palmer ping pong tournament finally just wrapped up.
All right, a ping pong tournament. I remember a couple of weeks ago, you mentioned that the ship had to turn around for a medical emergency. You lost a week of sailing and people on board were going kind of stir crazy. Is this ping pong tournament a result of the stir craziness?
Yeah, so it started when we were doing that transit, and the final kept getting postponed because we got into the period where scientists were actually really busy working, so there actually was a lot of anticipation building for this final. So one day last week after dinner, we all tramped down to the cargo hold where the ping pong table is. And the finalists came out in national dress, so one of the marine technicians had the letters USA taped onto the back of his jacket, and then a Swedish student had a Swedish flag clipped to the back of his headband. The Swedish student ended up winning best 2 out of 3, and he got the goodie bag that we all contributed to, which had chocolates with labels in a variety of languages, a carbonated lemonade — there's nothing fizzy on this ship, so that was in high demand — a Ziploc baggie with about $10 of Norwegian currency, which is a bit strange because there are no Norwegians on the ship, and then a pocket knife. So it might all sound silly, but, you know, there's not a lot to do by way of entertainment, so it's fun to see what people come up with.
So we've got a champion in the ping pong tournament aboard the Nathaniel B. Palmer. I want you to talk about something else, though, Carolyn, today, and that's the ice. There's a slow return of sea ice that melted over the southern summer down there, which is coming to an end now.
Yeah, it's funny because we have this occasional entertainment like a ping pong tournament, but really what people do most of all when they have any free time is go up to the bridge of the ship and just watch what's going on out the windows. And I've become totally obsessed with the formation of sea ice down here as it turns toward winter, watching it start as these darker streaks on the top of the water and then form into this cloudy film and then eventually a brittle, thin sheet of ice that sounds like this when it scrapes against the hull of the ship. So I asked a marine technician on the Palmer named Joey Patterson to give me a sort of lesson in the different kinds of ice here, how they form. She's on her 9th Antarctic voyage, so she's seen this all before. From the bridge, we climb up 3 ladders to the ship's lookout point, which is something like 80 feet above the water. Okay.
All right.
360 views. We're in a tiny enclosed tower, about twice the span of Joey's arms. The sea is choppy and gray with these dark streaks running toward us. They're made up of tiny ice crystals with the delightful name of frazzle. And when enough of them form to create these streaks, Joey says they're called grease ice.
It looks like grease or oil has been spilled across the top of the water. Like the chop is down and there's no white caps and you can just barely see the swell of the ocean underneath.
Okay, so the next stage is, I think, my favorite word. Sugar.
So, yeah, I think
sugar forms from grease ice, and there are patches of it growing to our left and right. It's grayish, whitish, like sugar that got thrown into water and didn't dissolve. It flattens out the waves even more than grease ice, so the sea gently undulates underneath it. Inside those hazy gray patches of sugar, we can see tiny round disks of solid ice starting to form. Joey says that's the next step, pancake ice.
As it gets colder and colder, the water is trying to freeze into a sheet, but there's movement, so it's breaking that sheet apart. And you get these little chunks of ice that, as they get sort of tossed and blown by the wind and current, it rounds off the edges a little bit.
I love the names.
Yeah, I do too. Like, who came up with these?
They're either like really cool words, like frazzle, or they're perfectly descriptive, like grease ice and pancake ice. Like, I can picture that in my head.
Yeah.
It's so good. Okay, so according to Bowditch, that's what's known as the Mariner's Bible by Nathaniel Bowditch.
Any single piece of relatively flat sea ice that is less than 20 meters across is called an ice cake.
Joey says ice cakes grow into ice floes and ice fields, which are still a little flexible.
You can actually see the sea swell moving under the ice field. It's very disorienting because the ground is just like gently rippling underneath you.
Eventually, as the ice gets thicker, it starts to be named by how long it's been around. First year, second year, multi-year. Freezing up can happen fast down here. Ice can grow from nothing to 5 inches thick in just 2 days and up to 6 feet over its first winter.
It's kind of crazy to think eventually some of those little pancakes are going to become that like massive multi-year ice that we were like working so hard to break through on our way down.
Marine technician Joey Patterson there, speaking with the world's Carolyn Beeler, both on the research ship, the Nathaniel B. Palmer, in the waters just off Antarctica. Carolyn, stick around for another minute, if you would. With that ice starting to reform, is it getting tougher for the ship to maneuver down there?
Well, it's the captain's job to make sure it's not too tough. He is keeping a very close eye on ice imagery sent down specifically for our path where we're going by the National Ice Center. So he's keeping a close eye on that, always looking for what he calls a runway out of the ice or a path. And he also is keeping an eye on weather as far away as Australia, because that can give him a pretty good sense of the kinds of weather patterns that we'll be seeing here in about 10 days' time. So he'll be making the ultimate call about when we have to turn around and head home before the ice starts to form up too much.
That's the world's Carolyn Beeler, afloat on the Amundsen Sea off West Antarctica. Carolyn, thanks as always. Stay warm, stay safe.
Thanks, Marco.
We've got more about the research team and photos of the freezing Amundsen Sea. That's all in Carolyn's latest dispatch at theworld.org. And before we go today, a quick Brexit update from the UK. Parliament today voted down a proposal for a so-called no-deal Brexit. This after British lawmakers overwhelmingly rejected the deal Prime Minister Theresa May had negotiated with the EU. That was yesterday. So members of Parliament didn't like May's deal, but they don't want to leave the EU without a deal either. Which leads us to a third vote expected tomorrow on whether to request an extension to the entire Brexit process. Big week for Brexit votes in London. We'll keep you posted and unconfused. That is our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.